Welcome. Here's Fred Kuhn and our next guest. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. Today, my guest is Lisa Barrington, and the other guest is Susan Savitt, both experienced and expert on the field of sexual harassment and discrimination. The question that I have for the both of you is, what are an accuser's rights? And likewise, what are the rights of the company?
I think this is important, Fred, because I think that many organizations recognize that the accuser has certain rights, but I think they're not always aware of the rights of the accused. So let's start with the person who's making allegations. Certainly, by law, they have a right to have an investigation done into their complaints and an expectation that appropriate action is taken to either eliminate illegal or inappropriate behavior, or if it doesn't rise to the level of illegal, to certainly mitigate it so it does not interfere with their ability to do their job. Because some people have higher sensitivity to what they feel is inappropriate that might not rise to the level of sexual harassment. So it's not always sexual harassment. If somebody's in the workplace and someone else asks them to go out on a date and they say no, certainly that one time, and if there's no other related behavior, it's a one-time event, there's no other behavior, does not constitute sexual harassment, but that person might be uncomfortable continuing to work with someone who asked them out on a date and never treats them any differently and never does anything in respect to the fact that they were denied or declined. That's not sexual harassment. It's one time, it's not severe, it's not pervasive. But that person might be uncomfortable just simply having to look at that person every day. So that's an example. Now, if that person either continued to ask them out, even though they'd said no, or if they treat them differently because they said no, that might constitute sexual harassment in some cases, depending on the severity. Go ahead, Susan.
I just wanted to emphasize that if you're going to do training, that you have to let everybody know that no means no.
Very good point. So to Susan's point, once someone has said no to a date, that other person should not be asking them out again. Not even a year later because they think, oh, well, now they've broken up with that other person and they're ready. It's incumbent upon them to just accept no and leave it alone. Now, if the person said, not now, I'm dating someone else, or I'm just not interested, try again, that'd be a different circumstance.
Sure, but once there's
an absolute no, it's an absolute no. The second thing that they have a right to do is if they believe that they've been discriminated against, although they should be encouraged to come to the employer and let them know so they can look into it, they still have the right either concurrently or instead of, or afterwards, to go to a state or federal agency and file a complaint. And no action can be taken against them for filing such a complaint. Which leads me to retaliation. They cannot be retaliated against from the company, from their colleagues, or the accused. And retaliation can look different in a couple different ways. So, for example, they could have been found to have been discriminated against, and an action could be taken against another employee or their boss, and that boss or other employee can retaliate against them by continuing to harass them, increasing the harassment, having others harass them, taking an employment action against them for the allegation. Also, and this is what most people don't realize, is if they made an allegation and it wasn't shown to be harassment, and so the organization investigated and said, no harassment occurred, and the person who was accused still took any kind of action against the accuser, it's still retaliation. So retaliation occurs whether they were found to have engaged in sexual harassment or not. Either way, it's still illegal retaliation.
Let's go look at the other side of the coin now. What about the company or the accused?
Exactly. So the person who's been accused has some right to some kind of a due process and really as much confidentiality as you can offer them. It's really important not to take precipitous action against them. And that goes for whether it's a colleague or whether it's a boss. The company itself as a whole doesn't really have any rights. It's those individuals in the company. Now, what I won't stop and say, though, is whether it's the accused or the company as a whole, here's what they have an expectation of, and to a certain degree a right under slander and libel laws, and that is someone can't arbitrarily accuse someone of sexual harassment where they are either making something up, outright lying, or embellishing intentionally to try to get some kind of an award or something in their favor. That could amount to slander or libel, and that would be the right that the company has, is to be free from that. And I'm sure Susan has much to add on this topic.
I'll try to be brief because this is a very complicated problem. But for instance, with the accuser, historically, a lot of employers reacted by transferring the accuser out of the situation. That is a no-no. You can't just automatically send away the person who's saying that some harassment is occurring. It could be that either party should be transferred. And if you have a history of always sending out the woman, it's going to go against you. In terms of once a charge or something has been filed, as an attorney, I'm going to come in and I'm going to assume originally that I'm going to represent the employer and the accused until there is some problem and I see that the individual may have done something, and then I have to cut them loose because it behooves me to be able to defend them both. Because once the employee is found to have done the harassment, then it's harder for me to defend the case. But as an attorney, I will say to these people, I'm going to defend you both right now. But once I find out there's a problem, I'm going to cut the employee, that's the accused, loose, and you're going to have to go get your own attorney. And another thing, and we probably should have addressed it earlier, again, we're going to be involved in a case where all kinds of discovery occurs. So in doing training and doing surveys or whatever, you're going to know that that is going to come out in a court proceeding, in a charge. So I know a lot of HR people like to do surveys and they like to do training and ask questions and record what goes on, but that's all going to end up being evidence somewhere down the line. So that's where I, as an employment attorney, sometimes don't have the same interest as the HR person who's trying to obviate some good behavior. I'm afraid you're going to find out information that's bad behavior and it's going to be used against you. I'm sure Lisa's point of view is going to take over in that case, but it's difficult when you're defending a case when there's a documented history of discrimination and the EOC or the other side is going to be able to get a hold of it.
Susan makes an excellent point. It is important and relevant for organizations to continuously survey their employees to understand what the employee needs are, what will motivate those employees, what's not working and what is working. However, there is always the risk that the responses in those surveys might provide information to that organization that puts them on notice that people believe that there's an environment that allows sexual harassment or some other type of illegal behavior. So whether it's through the comments or whether it's through the questions, the employer has to be very careful if they're going to survey their employees, and I do suggest they do that, that they follow up on the responses. If they allow open-ended comments, they should be using software that checks for certain words, and then they should be able to tie that back to a particular group and be able to do follow-up focus groups or even an investigation if necessary with those groups, never to an individual, but to those groups. And if there's questions that lead to an assumption that there's something going on that's either illegal or might rise to that level, once again, they should be able to go back to a group and figure out where that came from and do some follow-up with that group so they can ensure that they're reducing any kind of possibility of harassment.
Sounds to me like a lot of study and a lot of training. It's a minefield, legal minefield. I feel like I'm listening to a game of whack-a-mole. Well, that's an issue in and of itself. Susan, do you have any more that you'd like to say about this issue, about the rights of the accuser versus the rights of the accused?
And not really. The accused has, as Lisa said, due process rights. And I think you should, as the employer, listen to both sides and then make a decision. And then look at your own behavior to see whether or not you're always finding that the accused is correct or the accuser is correct, because then you might have a problem with your people who are investigating the issue. If you're a small employer, I think, as Lisa said, it might be a good idea to get somebody else outside of the company to look into it and keep your mind open to whatever decision they come up with. And it's difficult. I think it's very difficult for small employers to do it. And you also, and I don't know how many people listening work for school districts or camps or other facilities, wise, that have, you know, kids involved. And in some of those cases, judges and courts are going to look to see whether or not the kids have been harassed or are being harassing other individuals. So if you have children involved, you may need to have additional procedures and things in place. And again, have a due process system set up for both the individuals filing the charges as well as the individuals who are being accused.
Not only are we looking at the rules in different states, municipalities, and the EEOC, we also have executive orders in relationship to affirmative action, and that also adds protection. But there's one other thing I also want to mention. It's Title IX in universities. So universities have additional responsibilities to protect people from harassment, students and employees. But in particular, they have laws that cover those students and require a great deal of action and structure in place to protect employees.
You very often have to have special policies that protect the students, both, you know, at an elementary high school level as well as college level.
Fascinating, ladies. Thank you so much. Lisa Barrington, Susan Savitt, experts in this particular area of law and human resources. Very good comments. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. If you wish to speak with Fred or you want a transcript of this interview, send an email to podcast@stuartcoopercoon.com. See you soon.